This is Juhi Kwan. Today is July 29th, 2013, and I am here with Sujatha Jesu Dawson in her office in Oakland for Coraline. And this is for the Asian American Reproductive Justice Oral History Project. Okay, so let's start at the very beginning, wherever you want to deem that.
Okay.
Maybe about how you grew up and what kind of developed your political consciousness.
Sure. So I was born in the United States in Madison, Wisconsin in the mid-60s. Mm-hmm. Both my parents were graduate students at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and it was really kind of the height of the 60s anti-war activism. And so I very much grew up with a sense of the kind of social change possibilities, and activism was very, a very integral part of that growing up. We lived in graduate student housing, so it was a very multiracial graduate student housing. I just remember both my parents staying up late with other grad students talking about politics and smoking pot and listening to music. It was the 60s. I have very clear memories of that. And then when I was 5 years old, both my parents finished their graduate studies and we went back to India.
Okay.
So I lived in India. I lived in New Delhi for 8 years till I was 13 years old. And then we came back to the United States again, to Madison once again. And I went through, I guess, eighth grade, high school, and then college in Madison, and then came out. No, after college, I worked for 5 years doing community organizing in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Did grassroots neighborhood-based organizing.
How was that?
You know, Milwaukee was an interesting town. It was one of those kind of, you know, Rust Belt towns in the sense that used to have a very large working class population, a very large African American population that had just really suffered with the changing economy. It was both, there was a very much of a sense that grassroots organizing was really important. I mean, a little bit, I mean, I'd say, so what, there's a 6 year age difference between me and Barack Obama. Yes, it does. You know, we were part of that generation that really did believe in community organizing and that was an honorable profession. So I did that for 5 years. I did neighborhood-based organizing, and then I worked for the National 9 to 5, so it was National Association of Working Women, and I helped organize women who were out on welfare at the time fight for paid family leave. So it was a fascinating time to be doing organizing. There was very much of a sense of a kind of power to it. And at the same time, Milwaukee was a city that was very black and white. Mm-hmm. So as an Indian woman, a South Asian woman, there really wasn't a political home for me in the sense of kind of racial politics. And so my decision to come out to the Bay Area was both, I wanted to go back to graduate school, but I also wanted to live in a city that had a large South Asian community and Asian community. So the Bay Area was the place I came to. I did 3 years of grad school and then started working again, mostly because I was not a good graduate student.
What were you studying?
I was studying sociology.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, both, I still adore sociology, but I was not a very trainable graduate student. So it ended up taking me 13 years to get my PhD.
Wow.
But most of, after the, for the 10 of those 13 years, I worked full-time. Started working for a South Asian domestic violence organization, NARICA. I was first on their board and then their staff. And then from there, started doing more violence against women's work. I worked for a violence prevention organization in San Rafael, California, called Marin Abuse Women's Services. And from there, I went to working for a men's battery intervention program. And from there, I worked at, I got a job at what's at the time was a peer, Asian Pacific Islanders and Reproductive Health.
Yeah.
So I was there in 2002.
Yeah.
to 2004. So it was right around the time that they changed their name. So yeah. It's kind of fun to see it on the timeline here. Yeah, I was like, oh, wait, I was right there.
I just wanted to ask you a little bit more about the South Asian work that you did. Mm-hmm. What makes domestic violence such a relevant issue in the South Asian community?
You know, it's always been a curious question to me, but for some reason, the South Asian American community has been very organized around the issue of violence against women. And I don't think it in any way implies that there's more violence, but there's some kind of a political analysis, at least in the United States, that has allowed for the creation, at least now there are 30 South Asian women's organizations in this country.
Yeah.
And they're South Asian specific in the sense of they're not pan-ethnic in terms of Korean American and Chinese Americans included. I think the only other community that I know that has had kind of ethnic group specific, I know there are a couple of Korean American, you know, DV organizations or violence against women's organizations, but South Asian women, for some reason, there's been quite a few of them. And at some point, it'd be fascinating to trace the history and why it is that this group in comparison to other groups. But yeah, so I don't know.
Do you do like direct work, counseling, you know, hotline kind of work?
Yeah. So the group that I worked with, I was the volunteer coordinator, and it very much started with a peer-to-peer notion of support for women around violence. So volunteers would get 40 hours of training, and then they would be the ones answering the hotlines, helping women out, giving referrals, whether it's to lawyers or to shelters, etc. But it was very much, and they used to talk about it, they would describe it, or we would describe it as a, you know, sister-to-sister help network.
Okay.
And then at the same time, and this is dredging, really going back, you know, another, I don't know if you want to add this organization to the timeline, but at the time, so this would have been 2001, there was this case of a landlord in Berkeley, an Indian landlord in Berkeley, who was caught trafficking young women. And so there was all kinds of marches and demonstrations and a lot of activism in the community. And a bunch of us formed an organization called the Alliance for South Asians Taking Action. And so it became this very kind of political and politicized group talking about issues in the South Asian community, mostly originally focused on trafficking of young women, but later has now morphed into, I think, post-9/11 it became more. In which case, it must not have been 2001. Maybe it was 2000 that we started.
Yeah.
Maybe even, the dates all merged together. But anyway, so so at the same time that I was working at Nautica, I was also organizing ASAPA on the side.
And you jumped from there to the Oakland-based APEER.
Yes.
And APEER, from what I gathered, wasn't a very South Asian woman-heavy organization at all. It was, in fact, it was mostly led by second-generation East Asian American women.
Yeah. And at the time, I mean, APEER was a very small organization. So there was Evelyn, Dana Jean Paredes, who just recently left Forward Together. She was there as their organizing person. I was supposed to do movement building work for them. And I think they had, like, one other staff person who was, like, more...
Was
yeah. And if my memory serves me correctly, she was a Latina. So, you know, it was... I mean, we all, I guess, to some extent, were, like, 1.5 or second generation. Not all necessarily, like, deeply connected to our communities in the sense that we... I don't think any of us lived in a neighborhood that was an Asian neighborhood by any stretch of the imagination. So, yeah, but they had a broad enough vision. I mean, I don't know if it was the API that spoke to me as much as it was the reproductive agenda and sort of women being able to control their bodies. So that was the piece that spoke to me. And, yeah.
When you came in, had they already gone through the transition with HOPE and Khmer Girls in Action and things like that?
Yes, yeah. Okay. So I came in on the tail end of it. I didn't actually have any interactions with the Khmer Girls in Action folks. And partly because of that split is why they also started entertaining the idea of changing their name. So that's where ACRJ then emerged as a name.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you more about that. So did you see a direct shift in, like, the goals or the aims of the organization, like, right before the name change actually happened?
It's hard to say. I mean, because I was so new to the organization, I didn't have that much of a sense of what they did before.
Yeah.
I think Yin is probably the person who would have the best sense of, like, how they had imagined themselves before. I think they had a couple of, at least one large federal grant, an NIH or NIEH grant, that was able to sustain them. But they used to do much more kind of environmental
right.
justice kind of work.
Uh-huh.
But with the shift to the reproductive justice and the reproductive freedom agenda, they very much became much more reproductively oriented.
Okay. Yeah. What kind of programs were you involved in for, like, movement building?
Yeah. I think the two kind of programmatic pieces that I did was, one was reaching out to a lot of other organizations and trying to figure out, like, you know, what were they working on? Were there any intersections? And then hosting cross-organizational conversations about what were the issues that we had in common? Was there any work that we wanted to pursue? We had a name for it, something about conversations. Yeah. But it was also an organization that was in big transition at the time. So both there was the name change. We were applying for another big NIEH grant. Evelyn was out some part of it on maternity leave. So, yeah. And I think I was only there for like 2 years. So I don't, you know, it was 2 years when the organization was in transition, so.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Do you remember if they did any, like, local organizing work with, or, like, what communities they worked with and things like that?
Yeah. So are you going to be interviewing somebody from ACRJ, or?
Yeah, I'm interviewing Evelyn, but she could only give me 45 minutes of her time.
okay.
And it was really difficult to get the interview, and so I really wanted to, like,
yes.
Like,
yeah.
Hone in on, like, two or three things while I was with her, yeah.
Yeah. So at the time, they were working with young students in East Oakland.
Oh.
And that was mostly what Dana did. You should interview Dana.
Okay.
Yeah. She would be great. I mean, besides the fact that she was with ACRJ. She would have been with them for 10 years.
Oh, so she would, I wanted history.
Yeah, yeah, because she was really the one who did most of the organizing with the young women. So she developed, right about the time I left is when she developed the Sapphire program. So, yeah, so she'd be a good person to talk to for that.
Yeah, so where did you go after ACRJ then?
So from ACRJ, I went to the Center for Genetics and Society, and part of it had been while I was at ACRJ, the Center for Genetics and Society had brought together a bunch of, academics and activists to talk about the implications of the new reproductive and genetic technologies, and I had been invited as representing ACRJ. And while I was there, just realized the kind of impact these technologies could have on communities of color and women of color, and that there was nobody within our movement at the time that was talking about it. So, just going back to ACRJ, I just recall, so one of the pieces of work that I did help them with is, at the time, they were just starting to develop their reproductive justice agenda. And I helped in the very early stages of kind of articulating the difference between reproductive health, reproductive rights, and reproductive justice. So, and then just sharing that with other folks and getting feedback and stuff like that from allies. So that was a piece of the work that I did. But anyway, having talked to all these other organizations about kind of what's the cutting edge work that they were doing and realizing that nobody was really taking on the issue of reproductive genetics. So I decided to, Center for Genetics and Society had a opening. And so I decided to take that. And, Mostly I took it because I cared not so much about the genetics stuff, which I'm still not that interested in the science, but really realizing the implications for communities of color and women, and that the social justice movement broadly wasn't talking about it. So my agenda with them, with that position, had really been to raise the awareness and debate about reproductive genetics in social justice spaces.
So did you have any background in science going in?
No.
What?
No.
Wow, you're so brave.
I don't know if it's brave as much as just sort of naive, and I was like, of course I can. Can't be that hard.
Were there any, like, major challenges, or? It's a different, I mean, I'm sure it's different because it's Center for Genetics and Society, so they already have kind of a social issue lens, but often working with, like, scientists or even with my, like, biology friends, the conversation and the their framework is just very different, and sometimes I just can't get through.
Yeah, you know, it's a very, very different framework. I would not, I think probably if I had come to this through science, I would not have been asking those questions. And so it was really because I came from both a social justice and a sociology perspective that I was asking those questions. I mean, I think the biggest challenge that I realized in the work is I could be very effective at organizing social justice folks around these issues, but to get scientists to actually listen required credentials. And so some part of me being at UCSF now is that at UCSF I have now an institutional name, you know, institutional backing behind my name that at least gets people to sort of pay more attention to. So, you know, pedigree really does matter in some of these conversations.
Oh man, it's tough.
Yeah.
Let's see, where did you go after that?
So while I was at the Center for Genetics and Society, I was the director of their program on gender justice and human genetics. And a big part of what I was doing there was also once again reaching out to social justice groups, educating them about the issue, helping them understand the basic science of this. And while I was there, I was at Center for Genetics and Society for 4 years and realized that they were a public interest organization, nonprofit, that actually took a very clear stance on these issues, which was then hard for other social justice groups to figure out what they thought about it, right? And so I left the Center for Genetics and Society and started my own organization called Generations Ahead, with very much the intention of bringing people together across movements to have these very intersectional conversations about these issues, and creating the space for them to figure out what they believed about them and what their policy position they wanted on them. So it was a less directive and more coalitional building. And in many ways, technical assistance providing organization. So,
did you bring in your past experiences with, like, race, gender, kind of into that work as well?
Yeah, it was very much informed by that. So we worked with mostly reproductive justice organizations, but some reproductive rights organizations. We brought them together with disability rights groups and with LGBT groups to talk about, like, well, what does it mean, you know, when we're talking about assisted reproductive technologies for LGBT folks, and what does it mean for, you know, the issue of choice, and how does disability and disability, you know, discrimination play into all of these decisions?
Yeah, I was actually really interested in, like, the intersection between reproductive rights and disability rights, because I don't think a lot of people have talked about that. What are some, like, tensions or conflicts that could come up in those conversations?
Well, I mean, truthfully, the state of that conversation is that there's really no conversation between those two movements. We did a series of roundtable conversations, and there's actually a report that's still on the Generations Ahead website that is probably worth checking out, where we essentially brought those two groups together and said, you know, what would make for a fruitful conversation? And part of it was, it made a difference when it was more reproductive justice folks who were at the table, because they understood that, you know, people have, you know, they live these intersectional lives with multiple lived experiences, and so it's not like there's just one issue that trumps all the others. And for the disability rights folks, I think for them to be in a conversation with people that wasn't just about disability, but was also about race and class made a difference. And so there was more of an opening and a more possibility for folks to build alliances. And in fact, a group of folks came together to write a position statement, and it was a petition that went around. It's also on the Generations Ahead website about how important it is not to pit disability rights against reproductive rights, and that you could actually think of them together in complementary ways. So,
I mean, there's a lot of intersections, but I feel like, especially with the people that I've interviewed, they've just been like, you know, I don't really know very much about that, or there's not really much going on about it, but
yeah,
it's really important.
Yeah. In Generations Ahead, we had a very active disability rights program. And so we did a lot of work with, you know, the World Institute on Disability and the Disability Rights Education Defense Fund. And in fact, we also brought together, I want to say, 15 disability rights leaders to create the space for them to talk about new, you know, reproductive genetic technologies and what they thought about them and what their position was on them. And so that's also another report that's on the website. So
yeah. I mean, I've glanced through that, but I'll go and dump it.
Yeah.
One of the other reports you did was also on sex selection, right? And it kind of became really, really relevant with the state's Prenda laws and things like that. Do you have like any personal perspectives on?
Well, so Generations Ahead. We really took up the issue of sex selection for many reasons. One, because it was such an intersectional issue, right? So clearly, race is very deeply embedded in any conversation around sex selection. And also, it was such for us the leading edge of the conversation around reproductive technologies, right? So if we believe in a pro-choice framework, are we saying that women have the right to choose the genetic characteristics of their future children? And sex selection was really kind of that on-ramp to that conversation. So we did a lot of work. We created a toolkit, which I'm sure you might have seen.
Is that also online?
Yes, it is online. Okay. And that we did that in collaboration with the NOPOF and ACRJ.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so we did the background piece on sex selection. ACRJ did some interactive exercises around sex selection, and then NOPOF did the policy piece of that toolkit. And then we just did a lot of, let's see, the last 2 years of Generations Ahead, we focused pretty intensely on the issue of sex selection. So both trying to bridge the divide between the Asian women's organizations, including violence, like so the South Asian women's organizations, the DV organizations, and the reproductive rights organizations in terms of talking about this. We first took it on around the federal legislation, the Prenda, and then we started seeing it in states. And the first state, I think, was Georgia, where they had the race and sex selection abortion. So we also started taking on the issue of race and abortion and how all of those conversations were going. We did some really interesting work around cognitive linguistics analysis and how to talk about sex selection. And I'm trying to remember if we wrote up a report on that. I know we have a couple of position papers also on sex selection, but in many ways, we helped organizations, women's organizations, use the language of, you know, many of us are uncomfortable about this, but banning sex selections is actually not the solution. We really need to take on the issue of sun preference and gender discrimination. Which for many people, I think it was not an easy place to come to, just because their knee-jerk reaction tends to be, well, this is a terrible practice. And part of that, I think, is, you know, some notions of, like, it's those Asian women that do it. So it's easier to demonize.
Definitely.
Yeah.
What was it like leading your own organization? Were there any, like, challenges that came up for you?
Yes.
Always hard.
Yeah. Well, so I think, well, for me, what was hard about running an organization was, one, I was the founder, so everything was learning it from scratch, right? Like, so there were no systems in place, there was no infrastructure, there wasn't a senior team or any of that, so having to build that along the way. And when, so we launched in 2008, we started in 2008, which was also the year the market crashed. So the market crashed in 2007.
That's really out of your control.
Yeah, yes. And so for a while there, we really struggled hard to kind of keep our head above water. And I mean, we have a kind of a nonprofit system where smaller organizations can't really afford super skilled staff, so we hire folks and we train them, and then by the time they get trained, they take the next job at the bigger organization that can pay more, so there's a constant revolving door of training folks. And, you know, on top of that, in a competitive market, after a stock market crash, we had to show such outcomes, so there was just a lot of pressure to perform well. I eventually decided to close Generations Ahead, in large part because we had lost so much funding that we could have stayed open with a small budget, but mostly by that point it just felt like, well, I'll just, you know, I'll come to a job and feel good about myself, but how much impact could I actually have? And so we closed in 2011. So,
Who were the staff members that were kind of along with you throughout the organization?
I'm trying to remember if there was anybody who stayed. Nobody stayed the whole 4 years. There were a couple of staff who probably, well, Marina, who was the, she started out as the associate director and then became the managing director. She was actually there the whole time. I think she just started 2 months after we launched, so. But you know, and part of it for her was like, she had to be willing to be flexible in a changing organization to change roles. So when I hired her, she was supervising 4 program staff. And then by the time she left, she was like the half-time managing director of a very small operation with more consultants than staff. So
did you also reach out to some of your other networks and your other organizations? Like, because you were talking about the collaboration between ECRJ, NAPA, what other organizations did you work with?
So we worked with a lot of organizations. Our primary kind of mode for doing the work was collaborative. So we worked actually with Planned Parenthood Federation of America. We worked with ACLU of Northern California. We worked with the Center, LGBT Center of New York, like I said, Disability Rights Education Defense Funds, World Institute on Disability, worked with NARAL, Reproductive Health Technologies Project. So we worked with the Center for American Progress. So we worked with a lot of, most of our work was collaborative work. It was really about bringing organizations together to talk about what do they think about these issues, how could they integrate them. Worked with pretty much all of the reproductive justice organizations, so Latina Institute, CLRJ, California Black Women's, and in fact, I'm trying to remember what year this would have been, maybe 2009, we did a convening where we brought together about 22 women of color reproductive justice leaders to talk about what a women of color reproductive justice analysis of human genetic technologies would be. It's also another report that's on the website.
Yeah, but can you tell me more about the what went down, like in terms of like what kind of things were discussed and like if there was any like good conclusion they came to?
So we weren't seeking consensus. It was more an attempt to document the perspective of women of color, reproductive justice, a reproductive justice perspective on these issues. And so people talked about, you know, how can we, or ways to understand reproductive genetics outside of a commercial, you know, outside of them being commercialized, how to take a more community-based and holistic community-centered approach to it, really emphasizing that family ties were not just biologically based, but were actually, you know, social and created. And more than anything, they wanted to, they were advocating for women of color and folks who are the most impacted by these technologies to be at the center of the decision-making process. Mm. So, yeah, and for many of them, it was like, you know, so for the, you know, so the Asian women talked about sex selection and the ways these technologies affect their communities. The African-American women talked about just the history, the eugenics history in terms of the ways in which their family ties had been devalued historically, and so this presumption that these new technologies were not actually going to be respectful of family connections and family ties. And the whole biological determinism argument that, you know, if you have certain genes, then you must be X or Y, mm-hmm. or behave in X or Y way. So those were some of the issues that they talked about. Mm. So it was a great... I think we spent 3 days together talking about.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's crazy. Wow. I mean, like, just the idea of having, like, all the women of color reproductive justice leaders in one room is just, like, really exciting.
No. Yeah. You should just definitely check out the report, because it will give you also a snapshot of who the leaders were at the time. So,
Yeah. Could you talk a little bit more about, like, art and, like, possible problems and things like that? I know I don't want to get too technical, but I'm just, like, really fascinated by it.
Problems in terms of?
Just, like, potential conflicts, like, what kind of issues are relevant for women of color to discuss, commercialization of egg and sperm, like, surrogacy, like, all these things.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny, I mean, there's a way in which the approach to the use of all of these technologies in the United States is very individually oriented, right? Mm-hmm. So if there's an individual family that's suffering from infertility, then of course we should use whatever technological means, you know, necessary and that they can afford to pay for. What doesn't get talked about is the collective impact. Mm-hmm. And I think sex selection is one of those great examples of within a family, you know, a family might have either a strong son preference or mm-hmm. a woman might be under pressure to have a son. And it might make sense in that individual context to say, okay, well, let's use some technology to make sure that we have a son. But the collective impact of it, you know, in the aggregate does have some very important social, you know. Mm-hmm. And so the two big concerns around assisted reproductive technologies is both the ways it gets commercialized, mm-hmm. And part of the commercialization is just that there is less attention paid to safety, mm-hmm. right? Like, so what's the impact, long-term effects of egg, you know, providing eggs is still unknown. You know, there's all kinds of kind of mixed reports about, you know, is there a higher incidence of autism with mm-hmm. assisted reproductive technologies, etc. But in the long-term and aggregate, there's just this deep concern that we haven't as a society figured out how to talk about, which is if we allow for trait selection, genetic mm-hmm. trait selection, like, is there no place that we can draw the line, mm-hmm. right? So, you know, do we allow people to start selecting for skin color and then hair color or eye color or whatever supposed gene there might be for, you know, sexual orientation or intelligence and all of that mm-hmm. stuff? And, you know, from a technological and commercial perspective, there's no reason to draw the line, but definitely from a social perspective. I don't even know if I like the language of drawing the line as much as, you know, what is it that we as a society agree about the ways we treat people and, you know, sort of values. Because mm-hmm. This assumption that somehow these decisions about genetic traits are not going to be implicated by racism and homophobia mm-hmm. and sexism. It's not true. Mm-hmm. So.
Do you do similar work now here at Coraline?
I do. So 20% of my time is on research.
Exactly 20?
Exactly 20. One day a week. The couple of things that I'm still doing a lot of research and writing on sex selection. And then I'm also doing a project on egg donation and really trying to bring women donors back into the center of the discussion, because oftentimes people are saying, oh, it's too dangerous, or women should do it or shouldn't do it. But very, very rarely do we hear from women, like, why do they consider doing it? You know, what makes it an appealing process to them? And what do they want to have happen during the process? So we're doing that piece of research right now. So those are like my two kind of, and then I still do some work around reproductive rights and disability in the context of reproductive genetics. So talking a little bit more about the ethics of late abortion and, you know, how to bring disability rights folks, keep them in the conversation.
Yeah. So. I'm really interested in, like, the path that you've taken in terms of, like, you've done identity-based organizing, and you've also done kind of, like, this science aspect of it and this, like, broader academic, like, report-producing aspect, like, which, like, I don't know, it just seems really interesting. Like, what do you think about that?
Yeah. I would not say that I've followed a particular path. Certainly not something well thought out. I've mostly been somebody who has just followed the kind of when doors have opened and they've looked interesting, I've walked through them. I think that's how I got from, I got into the domestic violence work because I was interested in working in the South Asian community. From there, I was really kind of interested in working on women and body issues, and that took me both to the DV work, domestic violence work, and then to the reproductive justice work. And in some ways, like, all, so I talk about my work now at Coraline as, I mean, this was 20% is research, but 80% of the work that I do is, I consider it movement building work, and it's about building a new movement. And I think of this as a movement that's really about all people having the resources, rights, and respect to have, you know, love, sex, family, and community, like some very broad ways of defining it. And I would probably say, like, that's been the through line. It's like, you know, making sure that people have the right to love who they want, when they want, how they want, same with sex and same with family. It's like, you know, how can we be as both self-determining as possible in terms of love, sex, family, and community, but also within the context of family and community, right? So it's not just about what I want, but, you know, how to do it in a relational way. So, yeah. It's definitely, I mean, like I said before, it took me 13 years to finish my PhD.
And when did you finish?
2007.
Oh, so, okay, pretty recently.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
So you're a doctor.
Yes. And, you know, when I finished, I never thought I would end up at an academic institution since I was, you know, such a not stellar grad student, but here I am at UCSF, which is not, you know, it's a pretty well-recognized institution, so.
It is.
But, yeah. So, it's like, well, okay. Yeah.
Cool. So, yeah. Yeah, I think we also skipped over the part about your work with NAPA.
Oh, yes.
And you were a board member, right?
Yes. So I was at ACRJ when Kieran recruited me to join the board.
Okay. How did you know Kieran?
So when Kieran started as ED, she did kind of the tour of, like, meeting all the key Asian leaders around the country. And when I was at ACRJ, I think Evelyn was still on maternity leave or something. And so met with Kieran then. I have to admit I was somewhat skeptical of NAPOF just because I think pan-Asian organizing is challenging. We're much more comfortable, you know, being organized either as Korean Americans and Chinese Americans and Japanese Americans and South Asian Americans or Indian Americans than we are, you know, in a pan-ethnic way. But Kieran was such a compelling leader. I wanted to support her and her vision. And while I was there, then she transitioned off. And I decided to stay on for another 3 years, mostly because I wanted to support Miriam's leadership. And she was, you know, she was another very exciting, dynamic leader coming out of the LGBT movement, mm-hmm. and so brought a very different sensibility to the work, which was very exciting to see. So, yeah, and in that time period, so when Kieran was the ED, I think they had like four or five offices. Like there was New York, there was DC, there was Seattle and Los Angeles. Uh-huh. Like they had offices all around the country, and now it's more consolidated to, I think, just New York and DC. So uh-huh. there's been like a lot of transition there too. Mm-hmm. So come in.
Hey. I also wanted to ask you about Miriam. So you were involved in the selection process?
Yeah, so I was not on the hiring committee.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
But do you kind of know, like...
Well, so, just as an aside, yeah. So Miriam was on my board of directors at Generations Ahead.
Oh.
Yes.
Because she was involved with LGBTQ?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
The and New so, York... Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So you already knew her previously.
Yes, which is why I was not on the selection committee, because it would have been a conflict of interest, so.
Yeah. You know, was there, like, a shift in the direction of the organization in terms of, like, what they were looking for? Like, I know they wanted to make it a more national kind of presence in terms of, like, someone at the table to speak for Asian American women?
Yeah. I mean, so Kieran had done such a phenomenal job. I remember when she was hired, they just had a $50,000 grant, which I don't even think was enough to pay her salary. Mm. But she grew it from that to like a $600,000 to $700,000
wow.
organization within a few short years.
Yeah.
And so when Miriam came on, it was already an organization that had a national like presence, and particularly as a national reproductive justice leader, they had a presence. I don't think they had as much of a DC presence. Mm. And so that's one of the things that Miriam has really been sort of great as has been ramping that up. So they had a very high amongst in the reproductive rights and justice field, they had a very high profile around healthcare reform. Mm. They've definitely been the leader on sex selection in terms of policy work. Mm. And now they're one of the leading organizations around women's health issues in immigration reform.
Right, right, right.
Yeah. So to that extent that they're, you know, they're invited to they're invited to the White House tables and, you know, yeah. they're part of that kind of consultation
yeah.
that happens. Mm.
Did you, by any chance, get to know Sister Song through NAPOP?
Yes. So, actually, while I was at ACRJ, I was the staff person at ACRJ who represented ACRJ in the Sister Song.
Oh.
So when they did the 2003 conference. So I helped with organizing the 2003 conference. And mm-hmm. then I was on their management circle. Maybe, so 2003, so maybe for 4 years or so. So I was on the Sister Song Management Circle till shortly after they bought the Mother House in uh-huh. Atlanta.
Yeah.
And then I got off, so.
Okay.
So, yeah, so I was, yeah.
Could you talk a little bit more about that? I actually haven't been able to find anyone who knows very much about Sister Song.
Sure. That's a whole other history. Although you know that Loretta Ross,
yeah.
who was the director of Sister Song, is also doing the Sadie Smith oral histories.
Yeah.
Project.
She did a Voice of Feminism one.
Yeah.
Yeah, back in 2004, I think.
I thought she was still doing it.
Oh, is she? Okay.
I thought so. Because I think she was, like, recently at Smith College.
Oh, I don't know. Yeah.
Okay.
Maybe she is. I know she interviewed, like, Peggy Saika, Mary Chung.
Yeah.
People like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's see what to say about Sister Song.
I mean, you don't have to give me, like, the entire yeah. history, but, like, maybe, like, what you experienced out of it.
Yeah. Well, I think the amazing thing about Sister Song is they really emerged at a moment in time where, so this was around the March for Women's Lives. Mm-hmm. Loretta was a sort of key. Loretta, Kieran, and Sylvia Enriquez, who's the executive director of National Latina Institute for Reproductive Health, mm-hmm. the three of them were very instrumental in getting the march to shift from a March for Women's Choice to
right.
a March for Women's Lives.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a very powerful organization. It was a very powerful vehicle for all of the women of color to be a part of, to then advocate together for more place and more power at the table around reproductive rights issues.
Did you attend the march?
I did. I attended the march.
What was that like?
It was a ton of fun. and it was like, you know, they were just, you know, hundreds of thousands of people. So, yeah. It was hard at the time to get a sense of just kind of the magnitude, like looking at pictures afterwards. It was like very impressive.
Oh, wow.
So yeah. When I was in college in 1989, there had been another march in DC.
Uh-huh.
And I was in college at the time, and like four friends and I, did a road trip to DC.
From Madison, Wisconsin?
Yes, we did. Yeah. So,
wow.
Yeah, in some ways, like that's a little bit more than memorable for me. We slept on somebody's basement floor. And, yeah. But yeah, no, the march, I mean, it was more than anything, I would say, for the movement, it really changed the way the movement thought about reproductive justice as a framework, as a constituency, as, and there were very clear women of color leaders that emerged out of that in an intentional way. It didn't just happen.
Mm-hmm.
These women worked hard and made that happen. And so I would say after that march, the reproductive rights movement was never the same again in terms of a presumption of either more affluent choice issues or the lack of women of color leadership.
Mm-hmm.
So it was very cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I also know you went to the Michigan conference recently, right?
Yes. And I was also at the RJ for All conference. I was on the advisory committee for that.
Yeah. Okay. Just quickly what you thought of each one of them. Yeah.
So the Reproductive Justice for All conference was interesting in part because what they tried to do was take like some of the more contentious issues, you know, so in terms of like child welfare and assisted reproductive technologies and some other issues and really get people to dive deep on it.
Mm-hmm.
It was also probably the first time it was a collaboration of Planned Parenthood and somebody at Smith College. Patsy, no. Patsy Mink's daughter?
Oh, I know who you're talking about.
Yeah.
Gwen Mink? Wendy Mink? Or something?
Yeah.
Okay.
Anyway. But anyway, so it's those two folks, Planned Parenthood and Smith, hosted it together.
Yeah.
And it was also in some ways like the first time reproductive justice had been used by a non-women of color reproductive justice-led organization. And so there's a way in which it gave, I mean, there's both arguments about, like, did it appropriate reproductive justice? And also there was a sense that, oh, like, this is a very serious, you can no longer avoid reproductive justice.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Michigan conference was really, it was a conference hosted by the University of Michigan where they were trying to bring academics and advocates together with the hope that the advocates would talk about their research needs and the academics would then say, we'll do the research for you.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was a little naive in its assumptions about how research partnerships form and that a weekend is actually, was it even a weekend? Yes, it was a weekend.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was like a Thursday. No, it was a Thursday, Friday.
Okay.
Yeah. But just like that 2 days is not enough time to build enough trusting relationships to kind of move a research agenda. So it was great to see folks in the reproductive justice movement. Like, because since Sister Song stopped doing their conferences, we haven't, as reproductive justice folks, we haven't had a chance to get together.
Oh,
so,
really?
Yeah. So, yeah. Apparently there was a Sister Song reproductive justice conference in Miami sometime. I don't remember when. But, yeah.
How present are community members and community organizers in these conferences?
Well, community members and community organizers. So community organizers are staff, so definitely present.
Okay.
It depends on the organization. So I think organizations like ACRJ who do, I think they probably took a lot of their youth there. There have been a lot of kind of college age folks. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Mm. But it's not really a space for, it's not a community conversation about these issues.
Okay.
Yeah. So, I think...
Yeah, I have one last question to wrap it all up then.
Okay.
So, I know you do a lot of work here with different intersections of, like, race, gender, you know, biology, genetics, and I was wondering how you personally positioned yourself within the Asian American reproductive justice movement.
How I position myself.
Mm-hmm. Like, how do you perceive yourself to fit into the larger movement, or how your work gives mm-hmm. back to the larger movement?
Well, I always think of myself and the work that I do that's, I mean, that benefits both me and my community, right? Mm-hmm. So I don't see myself as separate. Like, mm-hmm. I'm not doing this work on behalf of somebody else. Mm-hmm. To the extent that I took on Asian women's reproductive issues, I consider myself an Asian woman who has reproductive needs. you know, to the same extent with Coraline, I think of myself as somebody who wants to have, you know, a rich life in terms of love, sex, family, and community. Mm. The same thing with the reproductive genetics. And in fact, you know, the sex selection is stuff that hits close to home, both more so in terms of the sun preference part of it than the sex selection. But, so they're all been very deeply personal. Mm. And I would also say, and this kind of goes back to the beginning of, as a child, you know, as somebody who was born in the 60s at a time of deep, big, you know, deep social change, I see myself as like an integral part of that social change. So mm-hmm. much of the work that I do is in service of a better world. Mm-hmm. So yeah. I don't see myself as advocating on behalf of a better mm-hmm. world. I see myself as agitating for a better world. Mm-hmm. So
one more follow up question.
Okay.
Also, if you had to choose, like, one issue that you wanted to focus on in the future, because a lot of your work is very kind of future-oriented, I was wondering if there was something that the reproductive justice movement needed to work on in the future, the work that still needs to be done.
Yeah. So for me, Coraline is that work mm-hmm. of, you know, we have a robust field with a lot of organizations, a lot of great people who do passionate work, but we haven't been winning on our issue for the last mm-hmm. couple of years. And so for me, the work around Coraline is, you know, under this broad umbrella of thinking about human beings and relationships and, you know, who we love and who we have sex with and who we create families with, it's like, I want us to build a winning movement around those issues. And so mm-hmm. that's, you know... Like, there's a lot of internal work that we need to do as a movement to change, to be more effective, and then there's also a lot that we need to change the world. So, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, thank you so much for taking time out. I know you're busy. You got after meeting.
Yes. All well, right. Thank you for being flexible, so and yeah, good luck.